All right, Roman numeral 2, having dealt with the views of Gregory the Great, are areas of important doctrinal movement. I didn't say improvement. I didn't say degeneration either. I simply said doctrinal movement in the medieval period. Now, the first of those is with regard to the doctrine of predestination. I think we can get into this most helpfully by considering the controversy ignited by one Gottschalk. You may also see this spelled, I've seen it spelled Gotus-Kelkus or something like that, which is an alternative spelling. But Genke and Gammerlach, that I'll mention in a second, use Gottschalk throughout unless they're quoting something else. So I'm going to do that too. Introduction. I want to talk about the problematic character of this controversy. The problematic character of this controversy is epitomized in the divergent estimations of Gottschalk himself. Some present him as speculative, vindictive, obstinate, and crazed. Gordon H. Clark, on the other hand, thinks of him as a lonely Presbyterian born out of due time. Well, it's quite a diverse perspective on him by historians. There are two difficulties to give rise to the obviously problematic character of Gottschalk. The first is the inflammatory nature of the subject of predestination. Let me say what he is particularly ardent to defend, double predestination. This causes many historians to lose their objectivity or misrepresent their sources because of their hatred of the doctrine of predestination. Well, an illustration of this resides in the fact that the first serious historical study of Gottschalk was undertaken when controversy began between the Jansenist Catholic predestinarians and Jesuits in the 16th century. The Jansenists were probably the last Roman Catholic predestinarians. Well, the second is the abstruse nature of the subject of predestination. That is to say, its complex and difficult character. The abstruseness or complex difficulty of the subject is all the more present since one of the main issues discussed was double predestination, which includes the subject of reprobation. Five issues are raised by these two difficulties: the ethical character of Gottschalk and or his opponents, the nature of his doctrine, the nature of his opponent's doctrine, the nature of his defender's doctrine, the nature of the doctrinal results of the controversy. So if we talked about the ethical character of his opponents as a separate one, you'd actually have six there, wouldn't you? If and when you read historians on the subject, be prepared for varying answers to these questions. The quality of answers will vary depending on the historian's objectivity and, frankly, their theological astuteness. But we come in the second place with regard to this controversy to bibliographical development. Thankfully, both the difficulties mentioned above have been much alleviated in the last century by bibliographical developments. These developments mean that there is far less excuse for extreme presentations of Gottschalk's life and doctrine than there were before. What are these developments? Genke and Gammerlach explained that in 1931, Dome, Germain, Maurin discovered a rich collection of Gottschalk's theological text in the library of Bern. Before that time, only his poetry and his two confessions were known to be extant. So, not 1931, they're still finding stuff by Gottschalk in obscure European libraries. With regard to their book, which translates all of the extant Gottschalk into English, because until their book, most of it was still in Latin, you know, so only medieval Latinists could read it. They say this: the present book tries to change this for the better. Excuse me. It's my hope that the availability in English of the 21 texts herein by Gottschalk and his contemporaries related to the 9th century predestination controversy will result in a revival of research on Gottschalk, whose role in the history of ideas is still to be fully discovered and appreciated. The present treatment is a refinement, then, of my previous lectures on Gottschalk, which were based mainly on historians writing before 1931 without the benefit of the original sources. The materials provided by Genke and Gemmerlach have enabled me to present what follows with much more clarity, accuracy, and confidence than previously. Treatment overview. With regard to the controversy, the outline of the following treatment of Gottschalk and the medieval predestinarian controversy which he ignited will be given under three headings: Gottschalk's life, Gottschalk's doctrine, Gottschalk's legacy. I hated it that I couldn't find an L for doctrine, but I just couldn't do it, so sorry. Gottschalk's life. I will follow here the very helpful divisions of Genke's introduction to the life of Gottschalk, and utilize extensively that introduction. First of all, Gottschalk's early life and education, which Genke says is circa 804, circa meaning about, because we don't know exactly when he was born, to 822. The exact birth year of Gottschalk is somewhat in doubt. Two alternatives given by historians for birth and death are 808, 868, 805, 870. Genke suggests the year 804 for his birth, but makes clear that what we know for certain is that he entered the monastery of Fulda as a child before January 28 of 814. Well, that's pretty specific. Well, that was the date of Charlemagne's death. And apparently, from the circumstances, we know that he was given to the monastery, along, I think, with a gift of money by his parents before 814, and when he was therefore just a child. Gottschalk lived, and the controversy surrounding him took place then during the Carolingian Empire. Gottschalk was sent in childhood by his parents to the convent of Fulda. During his childhood, and that would have been in Eastern France, and probably against church rules, during his childhood rule, Rabanus forced Gottschalk to become a monk. So, and this is going to become significant later on, because it actually wasn't completely according to Hoyle to force children donated to monasteries to become monks when they grew up. And it also had something to do with some controversies probably that his family had with the monastery as well, related to their contribution to it. Then we have Gottschalk the monk at Fulda, 823 to 829. Gottschalk, when he attained maturity, decided to leave the convent and brought his case to the synod. Either they decided in his favor or reached some form of compromise which allowed Gottschalk to leave the monastery. Ominously, however, Rabanus, the abbot at Fulda, in a treatise defending his actions in forcibly making children become monks, that was the treatise's theme, and a treatise defending his actions called Gottschalk his adversary. He also appealed to the emperor, not satisfied the proceedings of the synod. The successor of Charlemagne, one Louis the Pious, presided over the synod held at Worms in 829. Rabanus succeeded in his appeal, but Gottschalk was allowed to transfer it to another monastery in France near the Archbishopric of Reims, the monastery at Orbay. Genke notes that there's no sign that from this time on Gottschalk objected to being a monk in itself. So we don't know what happened, and of course the problem is we just don't have a lot of information. And at point after point, Genke is saying, this is mysterious, we don't know why or what of this. But perhaps the family's controversy with the monastery was settled, and Gottschalk's major problems with being a monk had to do with his family's problems and that being settled. He was happy to be a monk. He just didn't want to be under Rabanus, and so he was transferred to another monastery. Gottschalk's travels and relocation in Orbay, 829-835. Genki notes that this period of Gottschalk's life is, quote, enigmatic. This period was also one of increasing instability in the reign of Louis the Pious. Gottschalk apparently traveled before arriving at Orbay, so after the synod and after leaving the monastery at Fulda, apparently he traveled to different places. He apparently was able to study under a famous poet, I think it was an Irish poet, in fact, in the household of the Archbishop of Reims. At Orbay, he had the patronage of this Archbishop of Reims. Ebo was his name. And during this time, it appears Gottschalk gave himself to the study of Augustine and another strict Augustinian, Fulgentius. He became a strict Augustinian, concentrating his attention on Augustine's teaching in regard to double predestination. Gottschalk's preaching of predestination in Italy, 836 to 845. Ebo fell from power and lost his archbishopric around 835. This generally coincided with Gottschalk's departure from Orbay. Church rules permitted monks to leave their monasteries and travel if they were itinerant missionaries and ordained as priests. Among the vows that they took was, can't remember the Latin, it was something like stabilitas loci, that is to say, staying in one place. You're supposed to stay with your monastery, you're supposed to travel the countryside. And there are probably good rules for that in general, but there were exceptions made to it if they were missionaries, and if they were going to be missionaries for a long time, they had to be ordained as priests. Well, Gottschalk was ordained as a priest by Ebo's interim successor. As we'll see later on, that ordination is going to be questioned and challenged, in fact, overturned, because Ebo's interim successor didn't report the whole thing and seek the approval of higher church authorities for what he did. At any rate, Gottschalk was ordained as a priest by Ebo's interim successor and left for Italy, and he was probably leading a group of monks to the southeast of the Carolingian Empire on a kind of missionary journey. Of course, this was not an area that was not Christian, but it was an area that was in dispute between the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church, because it was in dispute between the Carolingian emperors and the Byzantine emperors. Northern Italy and the Balkan regions is where he's going to be traveling. Gottschalk's mission first led to Italy, where his preaching of predestination stirred both excitement and opposition. You can imagine listening to a guy preach predestination was different than listening to a guy preaching the power of the sacraments to save you. And a guy preaching that Jesus died only for his elect was different than listening to whatever the other priests were saying. And that is, by the way, as we will see, what he did teach. Almost as important as double predestination to Gottschalk was the doctrine of particular redemption, which is very interesting, but I won't get ahead of myself. Very interesting from a historical theological standpoint. Rabanus Morus opposes Gottschalk. Rabanus wrote Eberhard of Friul. Some of these names are amazing. Eberhard of Friul, where Gottschalk was located, opposing his teaching of predestination as dangerous false doctrine. People are going into despair. People are being confused. You ought to do something about it, Eberhard. Well, Genki argues that Eberhard was not overly impressed by Rabanus' letter. Apparently, he was more impressed with Gottschalk. At any rate, when Gottschalk returned, he was already gone when the letter arrived, from a mission to the Balkans. He gave no sign of feeling pressure from Eberhard and acted in a way which showed confidence in both his patron, Eberhard, and his own orthodoxy. He was confident that he was teaching nothing more or less what the great Saint Augustine had taught before him, and he was happy to defend his doctrine before synods. Well, that shows perhaps a little bit of naivete. Gottschalk's mission to the Balkans, 846 to 848. There are several interesting reflections on Gottschalk's time in the Balkans. It is possible that while there, because of his linguistic abilities as a monk, because he did know Greek and Hebrew, at least to some extent, Greek especially, I'm not sure about Hebrew. It's possible that he acted as an interpreter mediator between the local Carolingian ruler. I'm not sure how you say TRP without a vowel, but it sounds like Terpimir, and the Byzantine army, which were battling for the possession of the Balkans at this time. During his time in the Balkans, he traveled through Pannonia and Croatia and as far as Bulgaria. And in fact, I didn't know this till I was reading Genki, but his ministry there left such an abiding impression on Croatia that Croatia actually issued a stamp commemorating Gottschalk and his ministry in Croatia in 1996. Who'd have thunk it? And there actually, Genki has some pictures of a church that perhaps church building that Gottschalk was instrumental in starting, and some other speculations about the time there. But we come then to Gottschalk at the Synod of Mainz in 848. So he comes back from the Balkans. Eberhard of Friul shows him the letter, and apparently with great confidence, he leaves to go to the Synod of Mainz where he's to defend himself. Genki finds mysterious the confidence with which Gottschalk opposed the politically powerful and theologically respected Archbishop of Mainz, Rabanos, who had called him earlier his adversary. And he wonders if Gottschalk was, well, frankly, either naive or even arrogant. But he has no solution to this conundrum. It just seems unaccountable to Genki that given how powerful and respected Rabanus was, that Gottschalk would have thought that he could return and meet that kind of political, religious, ecclesiastical power at a synod. He just says, I don't understand this. Later he speculates that maybe he, well, frankly, is a little deranged, but I think the evidence for that is highly questionable. So he wonders if he was naive or arrogant, even later speculates that he was deranged, but he has no solution to this conundrum. Gottschalk, at this synod, presented two writings, a treatise in which he answered Rabanus' accusations and a confession of faith. Because he would not admit that his views were heretical, he and his companions were publicly flogged, exiled from the domains of Louis the German, because now the Carolingian Empire is breaking up among the sons of Louis the Pious. In fact, there was war between Louis the Pious and Louis the German and so forth, and Charles the Bald, and sent to his archbishop. So he was flogged, exiled, and sent to his archbishop. Here's an important name, Hincmar of Reims, in whose territory the monastery of Orbay, which he was legally associated with, was located. And then you have Hincmar's subsequent treatment of Gottschalk since 849. Gottschalk expected a more serious investigation of his case in Reims, which would vindicate him, and he prepared writings to defend himself from Scripture and the Church Fathers. Instead, a small synod was called by Hincmar, presided over by Charles the Bald, the French portion of the Carolingian Empire's king. Yes, he really was called, at least by historians, I don't know to his face or not, Charles the Bald. Hincmar and the synod, there are only 15 bishops there, Hincmar and the synod acted blindly on the advice of Rabanus, found Gottschalk guilty of heresy, publicly flogged him and forced him to throw into the fire the writing defending himself from Scripture and the patristics. He was also deposed from the priesthood on the grounds that he had been uncanonically ordained. He was confined in the Abbey of Hautvillers and sentenced to keep perpetual silence. Hincmar's conduct has frequently been vilified by historians back to just after his lifetime by historians writing on the basis of evidence from bishops who acted with him and later regretted what they did. But they also may have had political motivations for opposing Hincmar and vilifying him, so it's hard to know who to believe about what. So Hincmar's conduct has frequently been vilified by historians, but Genki opines that he was simply blindly following the instructions of Rabanus. In other words, the big archbishop of Mainz, so respected, so powerful, sent him the guy, told him what to do. Hey, he's not gonna trouble the waters. He's just gonna do what he's told. And that's probably the most likely interpretation of it. But that brings us to Gottschalk's imprisonment and writing at Hautvillers, 849. And again, as Genki says, a mystery surrounds this period. Genki again raises the question why Gottschalk behaved so brashly before kings and bishops. Genki suggests that Hincmar provides the explanation in his several statements indicating that Gottschalk was behaving in a mentally deranged way, refusing to bathe, wear clothes, and making claims to a prophetic possession of the Trinity. But the only witness for these things which Genki cites is Hincmar himself. Well, this seems suspicious to me because Gottschalk's writings at the time don't suggest any of these things or that he was mentally deranged. Also strange is the fact that in spite of the sentence of perpetual silence, Gottschalk was allowed to maintain an extensive correspondence. You say, what's going on? You're going to sentence him to perpetual silence and then you write letters to everybody in sight, to bishops? Genki notes, Rabanus was shocked when he learned that Gottschalk had such a freedom to communicate with the outer world. If Gottschalk were so deranged, as Hincmar says, why did he continue to allow him this freedom? And why were his writings so sane if he was so insane? Well, subsequent polemical exchange on predestination, 849 to 850. In spite of the severity with which he treated Gottschalk, Hincmar seems to have had second thoughts, doubts, certain qualms about whether his teaching was really heresy. So apparently all the quotations from Augustine had accomplished this at least. Hincmar was a little unsure of himself. Yeah, Rabanus said he was a heretic, and of course Rabanus said it. He believed it. But, wow, what do you do about all those things he's quoting from Augustine about predestination? Certainly sounds like what Gottschalk is saying. And so, among others, he consulted the Bishop of Troy, Prudentius, on this issue. The response was disturbing. Genki notes, his answer must have confirmed his worst fears. The Bishop of Troy, even though his tone was not at all controversial, affirmed a perfectly Augustinian teaching that clearly contradicted Hincmar's own ideas. Of course, that didn't make Hincmar let him out of prison. The monastic prison that he was in. The following years saw a seemingly endless succession of synods, discussions, and responses. The headings of Genki suggest this: Erigena's treatise and the Synod of Quiercy, 851 to 853. Responses against the canons of Quiercy, 853 to 857, the synods of Savoniere and Tusse, 859 to 860. Well, I pass over all that because it all did no good in terms of Hincmar's releasing of poor Gottschalk, stuck in his little house on the monastery grounds and not allowed to go anyplace. Aftermath and death of Gottschalk, 861 to 868. Nothing helped Gottschalk's case. Genki concludes, having several times refused to renounce his views. Gottschalk died in October 868, unreleased, and I think not being given the sacraments either. Well, conclusion, the assessment of his character. I began this lecture by noting the contrasting presentations of Gottschalk found in historians, some presenting him as speculative, vindictive, obstinate, and crazed. Clark, on the other hand, thinking of him as a lonely Presbyterian born out of due time. Well, as far as I can see, the presentation of Gottschalk as speculative, vindictive, obstinate, and crazed has mainly two sources. There's first the testimony of Hincmar, the prelate who kept him in prison for the last 20 years of his life. One might properly doubt the testimony of Hincmar on this issue, I think. And he did this, kept him in prison, in spite of his own doubts on the matter, in spite of Gottschalk's clear written testimonies from Scripture, Augustine, and other church fathers that he was Orthodox, and in spite of the witness of other bishops that Gottschalk was Orthodox. To use understatement, we seem authorized not to credit fully Hincmar's characterizations of Gottschalk's character. He might have had motivations that were not altogether born of truth. The second source of this is simply, of this characterization of Gottschalk, is I think simply dislike for Gottschalk's predestinarian doctrine and blindness to the plain support it has in both Scripture and the greatest of the church fathers, Augustine. I think this explains, frankly, partly Gottschalk's what Genki sees as a kind of arrogance or naivete. I mean, I think Gottschalk probably said, it's plain as day there in Augustine. If you say you revere Augustine, what do you do about all these plain testimonies? I think maybe that was a little naive, but it certainly wasn't arrogant. I mean, he thought he had the matter dead to rights, and nobody would listen. Maybe he didn't understand the power of politics in the matter, but... So to put it plainly, if Gottschalk was right about Scripture and Augustine, he was neither speculative nor obstinate. Rather, he was being biblical and bold. As to the claim that he was vindictive, if this was so, and I do not know that it's been proved, one tends to feel that Gottschalk might have had significant provocation. The claim of Clark that Gottschalk was a lonely Presbyterian born out of due time, while a little fanciful itself, is, as we will see, much closer to the truth than the alternative assessment of him discussed above. Well, that concludes our third lecture for the evening, and we are concluding a little earlier than I expected. Questions? Comments? Yes, Ben.
I think it's interesting that some of these historians, when it comes to predestinarians, how they so easily call them insane or crazy. Because in Brown's biography of Augustine, at the very end, he says, was remarking on Augustine's doctrine of predestination. He says, the last remorseless turn of the screw of the Augustinian doctrine of grace can then be disowned. It was no more than the reflection of a tragic hardening of the mind in an old tired man. And so you see their own personal beliefs on those things come out.
Yeah, and there's so many problems with something like that. First of all, by the way, this doctrine of predestination goes back at least to the City of God, written in 411, 20 years before he died. So you just see it, and it's amazing, isn't it? Ben has just read a portion from Brown who says that his doctrine of Augustine's doctrine of predestination was something caused by the hardening of an old man's heart and arteries, I think, or something like that. And And it's true, you know, it never ceases to amaze me when people describe Calvinism that I don't even recognize myself. That's because of their own prejudices. Other questions, comments? He sticks out because of the way he was persecuted for what he believed, and also probably because of his own boldness in asserting what he believed, and probably because of the fact that he emphasized the doctrine of double predestination and a particular redemption in a way that other people who maybe have believed the same things did not emphasize them. So I think it's a combination of those things. His own clear statements on the subject, his persecution for it, and the controversy over him that involved all these synods and later synods we're going to see as well that grew out of it. So, you know, in one sense, it might look like open and shut case, Rabanus is against him, locks him in prison, over with. But it wasn't over with. And it wasn't that simple because, frankly, there were a lot of people that were very sympathetic with what he was saying because they knew better than Rabanus or Hincmar what Augustine had actually taught. Yeah.
So were writings available to the reformers?
What's that? Were Gottschalk's writings available to reformers? That's a good question. If I recall, Genke says that one of the first treatises about Gottschalk was written by, they just came out with his theology, Solid Ground Books, Archbishop, and he was the predecessor of the Westminster Confession, Archbishop of the Church of England. I can't get the name back right now. 1590s, or maybe a little bit later than that. No, it would have been about the 1590s to Archbishop. He also did the chronology of the Bible. I know everything he did. He led the council of the Church in England that was the immediate predecessor of the Westminster Confession, Archbishop Usher, okay? Archbishop Usher was the first one that wrote a biography of Gottschalk. So apparently he had some things available to him then, so I can only say, I don't know if they had some of the writings that were rediscovered in 1931. They probably had a lot of, but there were a lot of histories written about him. Like I said, there was a guy that wrote a history based upon the testimony of the bishops that went to that council where Hincmar had him, you know, convicted of heresy. And some of those guys later regretted it for whatever reasons and motivations. And there were a lot of probably other extant materials about him. I think some of the rebuttals of like Rabanus and Hincmar were probably extant. I don't know if they had the writings that were discovered and burned in 1931 or not. Jeremy asked, do you think there were many closet predestinarians in the medieval church? Actually, I think there were. Closet might be the wrong word, but I think there were. There were, like that Bishop of Troyes that gave Hincmar the wrong and dissatisfying answer with regard to Gottschalk's views. I think there were many like him. I think the evidence shows that there were fairly widespread sense that really Gottschalk had it right and Rabanus and Hincmar were at least persecuting a legitimate view, if not the right interpretation of Augustine himself. Any other questions? Speak now or for 1 week, hold your peace. All right. Remember, next week, 4 lectures. And I'm preparing you for that by letting you out all of 25 minutes early this week. There you go.